45 years ago next month, an important institution in African-American education shut its doors for the last time. You may not have heard of the Bordentown School in New Jersey, but for seven decades, Bordentown was something of an educational utopia for black children. In its prime, Bordentown was referred to as a Tuskegee of the North. Only Bordentown, unlike Booker T. Washington's Alabama Institute, wasn't private. It was a co-ed African-American school publicly financed by the state of New Jersey. It was only after the Brown versus Board of Education decision that the state of New Jersey moved to shut down the school, citing its inability to attract white students. It closed in June of 1955. But for many years, the school held a special place in the hearts of so many of its students, including Barbara Wheeler, class of 1952.
The one thing that holds us together, where we act like we're still 13 and 14 years old, is our relationship to that school. And, you know, Bordentown was one of the world's best-kept secrets.
A new documentary, which airs tonight on PBS, gives an inside look at some of the lives that were shaped by the Bordentown School. It's called A Place Out of Time, and I'm joined now by the film's director, Dave Davidson, and Clement Price, professor of history at Rutgers University at Newark. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Allison. Nice to be here.
Dave, obviously, this place was special to you. When did it become that?
You know, once you lock into the whole arc of the story, which is cleaved to these incredible momentous events over all this time, then you peel away the layers and you do the simple math and find out that there are actually people in their 70s who were graduates of this place. So as far away as it seems in time, actually they're living, breathing, vital folks who live this experience. And it was at the point where we began to talk to and get oral histories from these amazing folks mm-hmm. that we were hooked on the story and really felt like it was important for us in some way, not only just to tell the story, but also vindicate them, because there's a lot of misunderstanding when people look at this institution. We wanted to square something up because their lives were changed by the Bordentown School.
Clement, as a professor of history, talk to us a little bit about the importance you place on Bordentown School in reference to African-American history and the education of African-Americans in this country.
For the first two generations of the last century, Bordentown was the capital of Negro New Jersey. Not only was it a school, but it was a meeting place for black teachers and scholars. It had a thriving sports agenda. Bordentown, on one hand, seems to be a Jim Crow school because only black students are enrolled in it. But in the black community, it was seen as a symbol of Negro achievement, of pride in the race, uplift, and all of those values that took shape in the generation after the end of slavery.
Professor, many of the former students that we see in the film talk about how important the school was in their lives. Here's a clip that I think will help set up my next question. This is Donald Robinson from class of 1952.
This school guided us to be achievers. We had teachers who were involved, who were dedicated, who pushed us. And we were at it coming out of here. 1950 was a time when, for a black person in New Jersey, or anywhere in this country almost, it was really tough. There were a lot of doors that you had to knock down in order to get in.
Professor, you said during the documentary that black people were enjoying their sense of separation. What did it mean to be at an all-black school in the middle of the supportive black community and insulated from the kind of racism and the effects of segregation that people that were not on that campus had to deal with?
Bordentown might be seen as a reservoir of black achievement. And I think as far as the alumni, those that Dave brought into his wonderful film, for many of them, it represents the power of their memories. They were kids when they went to Bordentown, obviously. And the Bordentown experience enriched the young lives of Negro kids who were isolated and insulated from some of the perils of racial intimidation and harassment in New Jersey.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We are speaking with the director of A Place Out of Time, with director Dave Davidson and Clement Price, who is professor of history at Rutgers University in Newark. Dave, from the people you spoke to, what did that isolation mean for them? How did that make them different than black students who were right out there in the middle of it?
In interviewing them, I think it's something that they really didn't recognize until later when they were out in that mainstream society. But in looking back, as they reminisce about those days, they realize that it was actually a color-free environment. That challenge and that stigma from those times was taken away. So they were getting a sense of themselves, finding out about their history. And it was really only after that where they stepped off quite successfully into mainstream society that they realized how strengthened they'd been by the experience at Bordentown for those years.
I'm interested that you said strengthened by, because I guess I'm thinking for those who felt that whites being in an all-white environment was bad for them, why would blacks being in an all-black environment not be bad in some ways?
Well, you know, whites didn't really have an institutional and cultural conspiracy against them to really destroy the family fabric, the cultural fabric where, you know, when Bordentown was founded in 1886, really at what they call the nadir, the depths of the Jim Crow movement, only a few years, a couple of generations away from an environment where it was criminal to actually be literate.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of coalescing of a sense of achievement, of a sense of self, of a sense of worth was something that was certainly long overdue, and institutions like Bordentown were critical in being able to create that in these kids.
Professor, one of the things that struck me was the level of moral training that the kids were given. The men talked about, one man said he'd been to a dance, but the woman was so far away she might as well have been in Florida. But they also said that the men and women didn't cross campus to, say, fraternize the way kids do today. Do you think that people that attended a school with such rigorous teachings, kids today don't have it. Are they missing out?
They may be. Of course, we're in an entirely different age, Allison. I've often argued that black Americans may have been the last of the Victorians in the United States, in that they used moral uplift as a cornerstone for their social, political, and cultural betterment. We don't see that. That is not as much of an issue now as it was, say, a generation or two ago. But when the film is screened, there's a very interesting wistfulness where people miss this kind of centeredness of a moral purpose in a black life.
Professor, what kind of things did educators at the Bordentown School have to do to manipulate the system to keep money coming into the school and to keep it open?
Dr. Valentine, the great and longstanding principal of the Bordentown School, was an extraordinary institution builder, not so much a student of Booker T. Washington, but he did have Washington's adaptation of the system for the purposes of the school, his ability to draw support without appearing to be a beggar.
Dave, that actually was very interesting to me in the film also, the kind of juxtaposition between the Booker T. Washington School of Thought. You know, kids need to learn a trade and have an education. You need to learn to sweep and sew. And then the W.E.B. Du Bois attitude that you needed to have a classically trained education. How did the school serve as kind of a microcosm for this debate?
Well, when Valentine came in, and he was a Harvard man, but as David Levering Lewis says in the piece, he could read the tea leaves clearly. So he knew to bring the shield of the manual trades to the fore, and behind that shield created this rigorous academic environment to be able to create the talented tenth. So he really harvested the best of Du Bois and the best of Booker T. Washington. These kids, even the ones who were college bound, absolutely had to master a trade to be able to have something, you know, certification to go out and work. And they did well even in the depths of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you were majoring in carpentry, you fix the buildings. If you were in plumbing, it was the pipes. And even more importantly, they had a huge agricultural section, so people were planting the crops and tending the livestock that would be slaughtered and harvested to actually feed the educational community. So the kids were invested in their own educational system and took great pride in being one, you know, important moving parts in that system.
Professor, some might argue that we're still kind of having the Booker T. Du Bois debate today. I wonder if you think that there are lessons we could learn from the Bordentown School that might give us some clues as to changes we ought to be making in the current educational system.
When we look at modern American life and history, the merging of the so-called Booker T. Washington ideology with that of W.E.B. Du Bois makes perfect sense. We should be useful and also have high intellectual aspirations.
Clement Price is the Board of Governors Distinguished Service Professor of History at Rutgers University at Newark. Dave Davidson is the Director of A Place Out of Time, the Bordentown School. They joined us from member station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Thank you, gentlemen, so much, and so glad that we were able to learn about this.
Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Allison. It's great to be here.
Half of all Americans who work for private companies are employed by small businesses, and small businesses accounted for nearly two-thirds of all new hires between 1993 and 2008. So are small businesses hiring now? This week we're going to pose that question to some business owners, and today we're joined by George Lesmeister from Indianapolis. He's the president of LGC Associates. That's a company that provides staffing for the hospitality and food service industries. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And why don't you explain your business just a little bit, the kinds of workers that you're getting placed in jobs?
Well, LGC, we're a hospitality and food service staffing company, such as you mentioned, and the type of workers that we provide would run anywhere from cooks, banquet servers, bartenders, chefs, anybody that would operate within the front of house or back of the house within the food preparation and serving. And then we also staff for hotels in roles such as housekeeping, front desk, and the administrative functions within a hotel property.
Okay. And when you think about the last couple of years and in this recession, what's business been like for you?
Well, I think obviously the last part of 2008 and the beginning of 2009 were challenging. But what you've seen this year is our revenues year to date are running ahead of what they were for the same period in 2009. We're still slightly ticking below what we did for the same period in 2008, but that gap is starting to shrink a little bit.
What was the lowest point for your business during the recession? How bad did things get for you?
Well, I think if you look at the beginning part of 2009, that first quarter, that was really tough. You know, we had to make a lot of difficult cuts and changes, and we retracted a lot. But I think it's made us a stronger company going forward. You know, it was that first quarter of 2009 was definitely the biggest challenge that we faced.
How deep were those cuts?
We probably cut back about 50% of our internal workforce.
50?
Yes.
Wow, that's a lot.
It was. It was significant cuts. It didn't come without pain. You know, we recognized maybe we had some replication of duties. Maybe we had some people that weren't producing at the levels that they were capable of. It was tough, but, you know, you have to do what you have to do to be able to go forward and be profitable. And that's, we were not going to fail.
Have you been able to replace or rehire any of those folks that you laid off?
Yeah, I mean, what we've looked at is you go on a branch-by-branch basis, and we have done some hiring this year. We did some hiring at the end of fourth quarter in 2009, but we're more strategic about it. Each person that comes in should be generating X amount of revenue to support their position in the company, and I think that accountability has made everybody better.
So 50% cut in the number of workers you had in-house for LGC. What about the number for workers that you were able to place? How much down was that at the worst part of the recession?
What I can go by is the number of W-2s that we generated. For 2008, we generated about 7,200 W-2s. And for 2009, I think it was around 5,600. So there was definitely an impact in our temporary workforce as well.
Well, Mr. Lesmeister, as you look forward, how confident are you in the economy as you see it, or are you hedging your bets a bit, thinking we're not out of this recession yet, we might be heading back down?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic. I mean, I think, like anything, you're always fearful of how new laws are going to impact your business and how it's going to affect hiring, but you try not to let that get into your thought process of what you have to accomplish on a daily basis.
You mentioned new laws. What new laws might you be concerned about?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a healthcare legislation that passed, and it's going to put new requirements on employers in the coming years, and you never know how if companies are going to be skittish about adding incremental workers or how that's going to impact us down the road. You always get concerned about that, but again, like I said, we just want to stay focused on what we can control.
Mr. Lesmeister, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's George Lesmeister. He's the president of LGC Associates in Indianapolis.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up in this Asian American Heritage Month, new research on sharp health disparities between Asian Americans and the rest of the country. But first, a touch of sports. Basketball, that is. There are four teams still alive vying for the right to be called this year's world champions, and not one of them is the Cleveland Cavaliers. Even though the Cavs won the most games in the regular season and have arguably the best player in the league, LeBron James. That may be why the organization fired its head coach, Mike Brown, this morning. Dave Zirin, a sports writer for The Nation and at edgeofsports.com, is here in the studios. Welcome, Dave.
Great to be here, Ms. Keyes.
So, okay, I know the Cavs are way out of it, but why is the firing of Mike Brown such a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because he's the most successful coach in the history of the franchise. It's a big deal because he was the coach of the year last year and very respected by his peers. But for two straight years, the Cavaliers were the favorites to win the championship. Mm-hmm. Two straight years, it didn't get done. And if they hadn't have fired Mike Brown by this morning, they would have owed him a cool $4.5 million. So It had to get done now. Those are the facts. Now, the rumors are that they're doing, and I know we don't do rumors on NPR.
No, never rumors.
But the rumors are that they're doing this because they want to be able to go to LeBron James, who is a free agent, and say, choose your coach.
But President Obama has been campaigning for LeBron James to move to my hometown, Chicago, the home of the once and future world champion, Chicago Bulls. Well, any chance King James is going to be, you know, in Chi-Town?
Well, Obama was also campaigning for Arlen Specter, so let's not go too far with that poll. I think LeBron James, it'll be one of two places. Either he is going to stay in Cleveland because, let's face it, his legacy, even at age 25, has taken a hit by his inability to push this team over the hump despite having the best record. And the other option is New York City, because I know that's painful to hear. I know it is, but let's face it, the Knicks or possibly even the soon-to-be Brooklyn Nets hold the opportunity for LeBron James to be able to become what he's always said he wants to be. He's always said his dream is not to be a champion, not to be the best basketball player ever, but to be a global icon, and there's no greater springboard for that than in the world's media capital.
How about the teams that are actually still playing? Boston taking on the Magic tonight, and the Celtics are up 3-0. Are they going to knock it out?
I have to disagree with something you just said, that they're taking on the Magic. Because I'm not sure the Magic have showed up yet in this series. I mean, they're
okay,
in the witness protection program of teams. So Boston, playing the artists formerly known as the Magic, are up 3-0. In the history of the NBA, teams that are up 3-0 are 93-0 all time. So you might as well just write it down. The Boston Celtics are going to be in the final
round. Yeah, but
the
Magic were heavily favored. Come on, you can't take them out like that.
Down 3-0, I'm going to. In the last game, the Celtics point guard, Rajon Rondo, had more assists than the entire Magic team. Not good.
There is that. What about the Lakers? The LA Lakers.
Very
2-1.
Exciting. Very exciting. The Suns coming back to make this a series, down just 2-1. Amare Stoudemire, 42 points and 11 rebounds. A brilliant game.
Big rebounds.
But I gotta say, I think these Suns are tough because they're mentally tough. I mean, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, was just a few short weeks ago, but let's remember, they as a team, from the owner to the general manager to the players, came out as one against Arizona's Senate Bill 1070, wore the Los Suns jerseys on the court, even though that law at the time had overwhelming majority support in their own state. They are mentally tough. They are as one. They are going to rage against the fire of the light and what some people think is an inevitable Lakers-Celtics finals.
Really briefly, who do you think is going to take it all this year?
I'm going to say the Phoenix Suns, not because I think it's going to happen, but because I want
to
give...
I might have to bet you a beer on that.
I will lose that beer, but I want to put every last morsel of karma I have into the idea of Steve Nash, Amari Stoudemire holding up the trophy and speaking out for immigrant rights simultaneously.
Dave Zirin for the Suns is a sports writer for The Nation and at edgeofsports.com. He's also author of the forthcoming book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Dave joined us right here in our Washington studios, and we are still making that bet.
Yes, we will miss
Thanks for coming.
I'm going to lose.
As that oil spreads along the coastline, the number of potential claims against BP is also expanding. The company has promised time and time again that they will pay all legitimate claims. But what is a legitimate claim, and who gets to decide that? NPR's Yuki Noguchi digs into those questions.
If there's a line that separates legitimate claims from illegitimate ones, it's not exactly clear where that lies. BP President Lamar McKay remained steadfastly vague during a Senate hearing this month, despite prodding from Washington Democrat Maria Cantwell.
We're going to pay all legitimate claims.
If it's an impact for business loss from tourism, you're going to pay.
We're going to pay all legitimate claims.
Long-term damages to the Louisiana fishing industry and its brand.
I can't quantify or speculate on long term. I don't know how to define it.
The Obama administration also sought more clarity. It sent a letter dated May 14th asking BP to clarify that the company will not leave taxpayers holding the bag on any damages BP considers not legitimate. And this week, BP faces the House Judiciary Committee probing the same issue. A BP spokesman declined to speak on tape or to discuss the company's definition of legitimate. But in an email, the spokesman said BP hired a firm called ESIS to assess all oil spill claims. As of last week, it had received nearly 16,000. The spokesman said BP has, in some cases, paid some claims within 48 hours of receiving supporting documentation. BP's assurances to do right by the oil spill's victims sounds familiar to Walter Parker.
Exxon did. Yeah, it made very similar promises that don't worry, we will take care of everything.
Parker chaired the Alaska Oil Spill Commission 2 decades ago, following the Exxon Valdez tanker disaster there. He says things quickly went sour. Exxon disputed many claims, and the side spent years in court. So Parker believes Gulf Coast victims will have a fight on their hands.
When it comes to money, I don't believe anything oil companies tell me. I don't trust that they would do anything to make the Gulf whole again, anything that amounts to anything, without tremendous pressure from all states and the federal government.
Exxon officials declined to be interviewed. A spokesman said the company voluntarily paid more than 11,000 individuals and businesses within a year of that accident. John Velsko, a fisherman based in Homer, Alaska, was one of those who received payment. He lost an entire fishing season the year the Valdez ran aground. To receive initial compensation, Velsko says Exxon required him to produce 3 years of fishing records.
It'd be like someone asking you when your house was on fire to dig out your tax returns from 2 years ago.
Velsko considers himself relatively lucky. Exxon paid him better than other fishermen he knew, but he says no one knew how Exxon arrived at those numbers. At the time of the accident, Velsko also owned a home on a lagoon in Homer, but the city blocked the water to prevent the oil from seeping in. Velsko sold the home at a loss, but says Exxon denied his claim to cover that. BP swiftly settled claims following its Texas City refinery explosion 5 years ago, which killed 15 people. BP later pleaded guilty to a related felony charge. Brent Kuhn says that was a relatively simple case.
Almost all those claims were extremely legitimate cases, and there wasn't much debate over that.
Kuhn was the lead attorney representing plaintiffs in the Texas City case. He now represents some injured workers from the BP Deepwater Horizon rig and several fishermen affected by the spill. Kuhn says this time BP will face many hundreds of times more claims than they did with Texas City. Waterfront homeowners, for example, are seeking to recoup for loss of property value. Coastal communities could see their long-term credit ratings hurt by the spill. All of those might seem like legitimate claims. But, says Kuhn,
you know, at some point, BP is going to try to turn off the spigot because of the nature and scope and extent and the massive amount of damage that's done. They're going to do everything they can for damage control. So they're going to say, we're not paying here, we're not paying there. The question is, where are they going to draw that line?
With oil still wending its way through the ocean currents, it's likely to be some time before that becomes clear. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Each Monday on the program, we reserve this space for our host commentary called Can I Just Tell You? As you may know, Michelle Martin has been away for a while. The reason, unfortunately, is a family tragedy. She stopped by our studios briefly to record her impressions for you of the last couple of weeks.
I want to talk about something really hard for me. The subject may not be appropriate for our younger listeners, so you can be ready to turn the dial if you see fit. And with that being said, I want you to hear the voice of a very good man, my brother, Norman McQueen, Jr. I interviewed him for this program on the 6th anniversary of 9/11.
I have a whole different outlook on life. I'm a little hesitant to make long-range plans about anything. I think that if there's something you want to do in your life, if there's a vacation that you want to take or someplace you want to see, I think you should do it now and not wait for retirement or plan too far ahead. And that's the way I feel about life now.
Norman McQueen Jr. was a firefighter in New York City in a privately funded unit called the Fire Patrol. He worked at Fire Patrol No. 2. His firehouse name was Mac. His friends called him Wade. My sister and I just called him Brother. He was funny, handsome, kind at heart, physically strong, an extremely devoted father, a loving husband, and a supportive, if occasionally annoying, little brother. 2 weeks ago today, he took his own life. I'd be lying if I tried to pretend I'm not angry. Stages of grief and all that. The only problem is I can't figure out exactly with whom or what I should be angry. Should I be angry with the 9/11 hijackers who flew the plane into the building that crushed the rig he sometimes drove and one of his closest friends along with it? The macho culture that made him reluctant to get help, even though the recurring storms of grief and rage that washed over him after 9/11 cost him his first marriage and threatened his second? Should I blame the inconsistent and perhaps even incompetent care he got when he finally did seek help? The job that disappeared due to budget cuts? The recession that left his home stripped of value? Should I blame his brain circuitry? Our gene pool? Because I am a journalist and I've been trained to research things, I now know that in this country, death by one's own hand is more common than by the hands of others. Some 33,000 people took their own lives last year that we know about. That's almost twice as many people as were murdered. In both circumstances, the deaths that receive public attention are few and far between. My brother's death did not, so far as I can tell, merit a paragraph in any of his hometown papers. And I understand that. He wasn't famous, although his picture appeared in the newspaper once when he responded at the scene of a terrible crash. But that's about it. His death didn't shatter the earth, just our world. Now, I know some people think taking your own life is a selfish act, but I cannot bring myself to see it that way. I see it as selfless, in the sense that you come to believe yourself has no value, that everybody would be better off without you. I think my brother thought he was a failure, that with his long bout of unemployment, he could not live up to what was expected of him as a man, and that we'd all be better off without him. He was so wrong. My brother was a good man. He was the first to offer to carry a bag of heavy groceries, to push a wheelchair up a steep ramp, to change a stranger's tire on a rainy night. Years ago, when I was a newspaper reporter and working on a story in New York, he insisted on driving me to all my interviews because he thought I had been out of the hood too long and might not be able to handle myself. I didn't have the heart to tell him that I had just had my car windows bashed in on the assignment I had just finished and lived to tell about it. And I tried to remember not to mention it when I climbed up into an office building that had just been bombed. I'm telling you all this because I refuse to be ashamed. I refuse to be ashamed of him or what he did. I hate what he did to himself, but I hate even more whatever it is that caused him to feel that his life had no value. Years from now, maybe there will be a pill you can take to stop this. Maybe, like the premature babies we can now save or the illnesses we can now treat, maybe we will find a way to treat despair. Until then, I hope that those who cannot see a way out of their own particular darkness will think of another good man and think of how much he was loved and is missed, and remember that they too are loved and will find some way to see the light.
Do you think that there will ever come a time when you don't think about it?
No, it's one of those things that it'll stay with me. It'll stay with everybody who's down there who survived it.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you for having me. Say hello to Billy and the babies.
I sure. I love you.
Love you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Funeral services for Norman McQueen Jr. are tomorrow. Michelle Martin will be out for the remainder of the week. If you'd like to send her an email of condolence, you can do so by contacting our website, npr.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Allison Keyes, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. There's More Talk tomorrow. Tony Cox will be sitting in for the rest of the week.